Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday morning. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Thank you. Good to be with you again.
We'll get to Iran in a second. It's probably the news story, quote unquote. But first, an update on what's happening as we speak. How close is this new flotilla to Israel?
It's probably 2 days away. It started from Turkey. The ships, both the leaders of the ships say that they will not engage in any kind of violence, but it's going to launch, I think, a series of these kind of low-key flotillas as opposed to the more visible and highly profiled ones, in the hope that they can either get through or, by being a constant source of annoyance, keep the issue alive. But this one, I think, would arrive probably by Sunday.
And, okay, so I understand that there's conjecture, but what makes you think it will be or won't be a violent end to its trip?
I just said what they are proclaiming.
Oh, what they say will happen or won't happen.
And Israel is much better prepared and much better equipped to deal with these incidents and knows how to handle it, both from a PR standpoint but also from a military standpoint, with the equipment and the knowledge of how to go about it and to use non-lethal methods to subdue it. But neither of the ships is the size of the Avi Marmara, which right. was a particular threat because it's a huge boat.
The Prime Minister of Israel has ordered an investigation into alleged leaks of plans to attack Iran's nuclear facilities. According to the Kuwaiti newspaper Al Jarida, the main suspects are the former heads of the Mossad and the Shin Bet, Israel's foreign and domestic intelligence agencies. Netanyahu is said to believe that the two, Meir Dagan and Yuval Diskin, wanted torpedo plans being drawn up by him and Ehud Barak to hit Iranian nuclear sites. Tzipi Livni, leader of the opposition, is also said to have been persuaded to attack Netanyahu for adventurism and, quote, gambling with Israel's national interest. Now, we have to keep in mind that just the fact that something like this is made public does not necessarily mean that the prime minister really intended to attack Iran, correct?
That is correct. The importance, well, there's two parts. First, we've been exonerated, so we're not suspect anymore as being the source of the leaks.
Thank God.
That's a good one. Second, if you've seen that Meir Dagan, the former head of the Mossad, has been making a lot of statements lately,
right.
He's been quiet immediately after his term ended, some of which do not make much sense, frankly, from at least a casual observer, unless there's something much more behind it, somebody I know well and have a lot of questions about right now. The reports really are very harmful, and was given to Israel's most credible analyst, Nachum Barnea, so that it was given a lot more standing in terms of the series of rumors that circulate in Israel daily. And the detail also about meetings of the prime minister with members of his cabinet. There are those who might believe that it would be delivered, because we're trying to send a message to the Iranians. Israel launched a missile, an updated version of the Jericho missile, which has the capacity of carrying a warhead, even a nuclear warhead, and of striking Iran. At the same time, in Italy right now, there are exercises going on, which surprisingly got very little coverage, where German and Italian and Dutch planes, each one different. One is the Eurofighter, one is the Harrier, one is the F-16, together with Israeli jets, are engaging in exercises which involve long-range targets. I want to be careful how I say this, because then somebody, they always quote it and say I said that they were bombing, you know, places in Europe.
Right.
These are very extensive exercises for Israel. It's the range that also adds to significance. If you remember, they were exercising near Greece. These kind of exercises are held every 2 years, but this one, obviously, the timing is very significant. And I cite this because all of these things are being noted as part of the broader picture. You also have the IEA report, the International Atomic Energy Agency
right.
report, due out November 8th.
Right.
And that is really important, and you know, you and I have discussed this.
Right. Let's get back to that report in a second. What's the collateral damage on this nuclear warhead? I mean, do you have any clue how powerful a warhead Israel would have to consider using if they, in fact, needed to take out the uranium enrichment plant?
Well, the problem is it's not one plant. It's many plants. The problem is that they are underground. The new ones that are a particular concern are built inside mountains. They are under construction, and one of the reasons why people feel that there is a deadline, and as European diplomats said recently, if you don't do it before the end of the year, then it will probably be too advanced to be able to take out. Some of it is built under 30 feet of reinforced concrete, so you would take it would take multiple strikes and probably air and other operations. What's interesting to me is that people are talking much more about a U.S.-European effort. Even the British have said that they've stepped up their plans for an Iran attack and saying that that they have taken steps in terms of their military training.
That was from the Prime Minister's office of Great Britain?
This came from British Armed Forces sources and the Ministry of Defense. And they say that the U.S. may decide to fast-forward plans for hitting some of the Iranian facilities, and that if the U.K. is asked to help, that they would be prepared to provide military assistance. And some of it is motivated because they feel that Iran has been able to bypass, with the aid of other countries,
right,
Turkey, China, the sanctions, and they are moving ahead. And the fact that we now have an honest IAEA, which, by the way,
well,
I hope we can talk about Syria also.
Yeah, we will, but the honest IA, I mean, only because now they're going to finally give the report that we'd like to hear.
Not because of the report we'd like to hear, but the report that was that has the truth. All along, while it was under the control of al-Baradei, who was a stooge of Iran, they lied, they distorted, they confused people about the facts, and now,
of what Iran had.
Report that is due out under comprehensive report about
right.
their findings. And China and Russia now are working to block it,
right?
To try to stop this.
So, what will be the difference? We have been, you know, the amount of what Iran has and its capabilities has always been, you know, quelled, has always been held back. What will be the difference now? We're going to see that it's much, much more than ever previously reported by the agency.
It'll be more. It'll be more sophisticated, and more importantly, the new facilities near Qom's, which I discussed here, you know, 6 months ago, 8 months ago,
right.
Will be examined. They will probably also talk about the linkages to a new facility discovered in Syria, which they believe is a uranium enrichment facility that AQ Khan of Pakistan, the father of this whole nuclear program, you know, all along they said he had another client state. Libya was one, and now they have almost duplicate facility to
right.
the one in Libya. Was found in a city, Al-Haqsa,
right.
in Syria. But
you got to bear with me for a second, because I just have to backtrack for a moment, because I even though my knowledge of mass destructive weaponry is limited, I'm trying to understand if, in fact, a nuclear warhead was launched by Israel, because we saw what happened in Syria. Israel was able to take it out and did not use nuclear weaponry, correct?
Right.
What would be the collateral damage? Is there such a thing anymore as a mild, you know, nuclear warhead attack, or this is going to devastate the entire country?
No. First of all, it'll be very targeted. Second of all, I think it's the last resort. And Israel has other capacities. The United States has other capacities to hit short of using a nuclear weapon. Israel has always said it won't be the first to introduce them. I think this is only a warning that if Iran tries to use it, because the belief amongst many experts is that they have a bomb, that they purchased it, and they purchased stuff when the Soviet Union collapsed, or they you know, they've been working with China, North Korea, and Pakistan
mm-hmm.
all along. So we don't know how far advanced it is. That's the bottom line. And that the amount of uranium that they've enriched, according to the former deputy head of the IAEA, whose report I mentioned on the air a couple weeks ago, really gave us an insight into the extent of it. So your concern about what collateral damage is, I won't know. Nobody can tell right now. I think this is more saber-rattling and sending a warning, because the Iranians have been talking about threatening Israel, and Syria talking about threatening
right.
Israel with Iran, with Hezbollah. This is a message to all of them. You better think twice.
And the method Israel used in Syria, that would not be sufficient in Iran at this point?
No, because, first of all, that's a completely different kind of facility. It was above ground.
Would Israel hesitate to go to Syria now with this new area?
With it, this is not...
With the new site?
This is not going to be necessary for Israel to do, and I think given the current circumstances, there are probably a lot easier ways to get in there and do something.
Mm-hmm.
But the it's built inside an industrial complex,
right.
And the question is it working now? If it's working, then that will be a very different situation. But the very fact that they discovered it, and now IAEA will probably be able to send in people to look at it.
One of the Israeli officials said that it's so much easier, easier is the wrong word, it's so much more effective to do this technologically, by computer, to sabotage the enemy's efforts, you know, with Stuxnet and all these inventions that the brainy ones come up with, you know, as they're trying to deter the enemy, and that it's more effective than using conventional weaponry or certainly nuclear weaponry. Isn't that a potent argument?
It is. And the question is, how effective is it in the long run? It can set things back, but it can't end the program. Stuxnet was effective. Eliminating some of their nuclear scientists is effective. It sets them back. It delays it, but it doesn't stop it. And the problem is that at the same time, they keep moving ahead with the construction, particularly of this new underground facility, which will create a new reality once it's done, and make it much more difficult to be able to take it out. And you know, had we acted on this when we first discovered it,
right,
it would have been a lot easier.
Right.
It would have been a lot easier to have done it a year and a half ago, 2 years ago.
So it's like military people say, no matter what you do from the air and other places, in the end, you need the conventional ground war to finish things off.
The question is also, what are your targets? If they may, for instance, attack the Iran Revolutionary Guard facilities. They may not go. They may go to a stage of blockade with American warships and our aircraft carriers. And they could have 1,000 missiles rain down on all these different facilities. So not to simply target the nuclear facilities, but to take out Iran's capacity both to respond to an attack, meaning their anti-aircraft, their, you know, some of the sophisticated missile systems, and then pick off the nuclear program.
And finally on this, Bibi's reaction then is very interesting, because he was pretty angry, right? It was a pretty angry reaction to the leak, so to speak. So that would tell us that, unless he's a great actor, that he really didn't want this information out there.
Well, first of all, it undermines your confidence in the ability to have any discussion within the cabinet.
Right.
And that is one thing, and they have agreements about not leaking stuff, and especially when it's such a sensitive topic, you want it to come out in a pre-planned way and a thoughtful way, not by virtue of people who want to stop it or sabotage it or embarrass them about it, leaking it to the media. And I think, you know, there has to be rules. There are countries I know that are afraid to share information because Israel's culture of...
Soon we're going to get to a point where a cabinet member tweets, we're not bombing Iran. You know, like, I'm telling you, it's like...
Send a document in to John.
I'm telling you, everyone will know about it. They'll be sitting in a meeting and they'll say, we just decided we're not bombing Iran today. You know, thank you. By the way, did you see this? Speaking of tweets, hours spent on social networking sites per user per month. Which country's number one?
Would that be Iran? Israel.
Iran's not even on the list. Amazing. Israel is number one.
Oh, sure. They have the most news. They have so much to tell people. We have so much going on.
You mean it's all about the haq.
What time mincha is.
Exactly. But, you know, United States' number was 6.8. Israel's almost double that, which is unbelievable.
That is unbelievable.
I don't know if it means that we're wasting too much time or we're accomplishing a lot. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Reminder, we're in the middle of our fall fundraising campaign, which kicks off our 5772 fundraising season. I want to thank everybody who's returned the envelopes in the snail mail part of the campaign to us and given generously. If you haven't done that yet, please do. And to contribute in an even easier fashion to JM and the AM and keep us going, go to jmandtheam.org. At the top of the page, you'll see the pledge box. And we encourage everybody to participate, and we thank everybody for participating. Malcolm, is Egypt responsible for the quote-unquote ceasefire in the southwestern part of Israel?
Egypt played an important role in trying to broker a ceasefire. I don't know that we can actually say a ceasefire is in effect.
Right.
In effect, whenever they decide to stop shooting and whenever Israel retaliates and then they yell stop and then they start, it's like little children behaving in the behavior of Hamas that, and they claim, of course, that it's somebody else doing it, but the rockets have continued this week as well. And as you know, there were heavy barrages of rockets, including some of the Grad missiles. Thank God the Iron Dome system works, but it, you know, it doesn't cover the whole region. So Egypt did help. Egypt's relationship with Hamas is better, and especially with the upcoming election. And the Muslim Brotherhood, which is closely tied to Hamas and to this whole network, likely to gain a very significant part of a number of the seats of the parliament. So right now, Egypt was in a position to deliver.
How come the enemy down there didn't do what they did last time, which was just keep going for months and months and months till Israel decided to intervene?
Because Israel hit back right away. Israel eliminated quite a few top leaders in the strategic strikes, meaning that they didn't just carpet bomb. They didn't do cast lead, but they used unmanned vehicles and other means of targeting vehicles and targeting individuals who were eliminated. And I think that message comes home very strongly. And I don't think the people in Gaza want another war. I think that they reject and resent this, and Hamas, not knowing when they could face an election and knowing what popular sentiment is, also has to be responsive despite there being an ultimate dictatorship and terror reign.
Syria makes a deal this week to calm down in regard to their methods when it comes to protesters, and we know what some of those methods include. Who is this deal with? The Arab League? And is this something that could actually hold?
I don't believe it ultimately will hold. I think it's a measure that Assad agreed to, which is a proposal for negotiations, even though he's had many offers, and he took a couple days to respond, came back with a response, mostly because of the international pressure that has been escalating and the threats of intervention by Turkey, by others, the demands that NATO do more. And now with Gaddafi off the scene and NATO out of Libya, they can turn their attention to Syria, something that he is very concerned about. So there are a combination of factors, I think, that come into play in pushing Assad into agreeing to this plan, but it also buys him time. And he believes that ultimately he will be able to overcome this if he's given enough time and can kill enough people, that this is really a foreign-inspired and not a domestic reaction and response to his dictatorial rule. So when you put yourself in his shoes and you look at all of these things that are happening around you, you say, well, this is an escape clause for me right now.
Right.
By the way, he's also been mining the Lebanese border. There have been many, many defections of soldiers who are now taking up weapons against the troops. That's why you have more shooting now. The demonstrators in the past did not, but the defecting soldiers, who are a particular target for Assad's forces, have been escalating the use of violence in some of the confrontations.
They're walking right into Hezbollah country.
Some of them are going into Hezbollah country. As mentioned, in Lebanon, the prices of weapons has doubled or tripled because the Alawites now are arming themselves to protect themselves in the eventuality that Assad collapses.
But you can't defect to an ally of your own team, of your former team.
Well, they're not defecting. They're just going to the border area, but they're also going to Turkey, and that's where you have...
So they're on the run. They want to escape.
They escape, and then in some cases, as in the case now near Turkey, the Turkish border, they are reorganizing to come back and fight in some of the cities.
And this would be against the present Syrian government.
Against the present Syrian government. But if you notice, and I mentioned this, that all of the actions are taken by the 4th Army of Syria, not by the other divisions, because this isn't the unit that he most closely controlled. His brother controls it, and the forces there are most loyal to him, and they're the ones who are carrying out the counterattacks.
Mm, very interesting. The PA at the UN. So now they are, in fact, a member of UNESCO.
The PA is a member of UNESCO. The vote was 107-4, but more interestingly, 14 against. But even more interesting than that is that 52 other countries abstained or didn't vote for it. That means 66 countries voted against it. Or certainly didn't support it.
Right, didn't want us to vote for it.
That's a huge number, and it's much larger than what other people and even the Palestinians had predicted. They had assumed people talked to 120, 130. And this is a reflection of the fact that countries do not want to get engaged in this. There are 16 other UN agencies that are now likely to be the targets for the PA, including the World Trade Organization, World Health Organization, the Intellectual Property Organization, and then ultimately the International Criminal Court, which, as I said all along, is the primary target,
right?
Because they want to be able to...
That's the big...
And as they hijack these agencies and try to affect their agendas, they will alienate more and more members. But I can tell you that even Arab and Muslim countries have said to us in recent days that they're sick and tired of this, that they're going to destroy the agencies. The U.S. is holding up a payment of $60 million due in November. The United States gives about 22%, about $70 million of the UNESCO budget.
Right, but will that change? Like, will the United States cave in on that or not?
It's not clear, but they are holding up the money now. It's not a choice for the administration. It's mandated by law, American law.
So it's not a unilateral White House decision?
It's very specific legislation. Now, are there escape clauses? Maybe, and we don't know what the administration will ultimately want to do in terms of the funding, because taking away the $70 million, we'll have to see whether all the big mouths, including France and others who voted for this, will step up to the plate. Will Saudi Arabia and others make up the difference for some of the good work that UNESCO does?
You know what I envision, by the way?
Find it.
I envision that certain states are going to be very key in the 2012 election, and that releasing that money is going to be a gesture that will be appreciated by the population of some of those states.
In the United States?
Yeah, I'm talking about the United States.
Will it appreciate the release?
Yeah, I think that there will be a couple, I shouldn't say a couple, I think there will be possibly one or more key states that are very close in the 2012 election whose population, a vast percentage, not majority, but percentage of the population, will be very appreciative if President Obama releases that money.
Look, the United Nations is not popular amongst the American people at all. Even Canada now is looking to reconsider its relationship with UNESCO. Israel, of course, stopped the $3 million.
But you can't see
that. But let me just say that I understand your point, that UNESCO, most people don't even know what it does. And at a time when dollars are so hard, people are happy with every expenditure that is not made that doesn't benefit the American people directly in their view. We know that UNESCO's agenda all along has been hijacked. And, you know, the very fact that they came out with that thing about Kever Rachel being also the mosque and all things we've discussed, and how till now they've had this awful record, what they will do with PA inside will be even worse. I don't think that the American people have much tolerance for that.
Okay. In the United Nations this week, Colombia did abstain, right? Part of the Security Council, correct, in terms of PA membership, right?
Yeah, but it's not a Security Council at this point.
It's not what?
You mean that this the vote in the...
In other words, you needed 9 out of 15 in the Security Council to make the recommendation to the General Assembly, correct?
Yeah, but we haven't come to that. That's going to be on November 11th.
So how did I read that Colombia is abstaining? They make a declaration?
No, countries have been making public their
intention.
Stand right now. And as just to remind people, you need 9 of the 15 members of the council to vote affirmatively for the measure. Right now, we believe they're at 8, but they don't have the 9th. The 9th is would be Bosnia-Herzegovina, which has 3 presidents, 2 of whom favor voting for it, 1 of whom opposes it, and as long as it's deadlocked, they cannot vote for it, so they will abstain.
Oh, because
Germany and France today announced, Germany and Britain announced today that they will, in fact, not vote for it.
Because last week, when you alluded to the quote-unquote ninth country that can make a difference, I thought you were referring to Colombia, but you were not. You counted on them abstaining at that point already.
We counted on them abstaining.
So Bosnia-Herzegovina holds the vote in the balance.
Bosnia could be. Nigeria, it appears, will vote for it. That we were hoping would be a vote against it, but we don't know until it actually comes down to the wire.
Well, we're 1 week away.
That's right. And the United States, Israel, and others are working this very hard. We've talked to many of them. I met with the president of Bosnia-Herzegovina also to talk to them about it. And by the way, on the other vote, it would be nice if people wrote to the countries that supported Israel, Australia, Canada, Czech Republic, Germany, Lithuania, Netherlands, Palau, the great powers, Panama, Samoa, the Solomon Islands, Sweden, which was the surprise, and the United States, and Vanuatu, to just to tell them, you don't have to vote to all the abstentions, but certainly to those who voted against. And if they go to our website, I think all of the names are there. And I hope they also go to the leadershipactionnetwork.org, where you can get a lot of the background information and stuff on the some of these issues that we did.
Yet another web address now to remember.
Different one, but this one, will, if you sign up, you'll be able to get early alerts to the issues and action recommendations, which is something people always ask. I know from both from the show and from when I go out to speak, you know, what can we do?
Right.
Now, there are no more excuses, because it tells you things that you can do that will help Israel, will help make the case.
If you're president of your Israel Campus Club, that's a very important website. You'll get the news before it actually happens. You'll be informed about what's going on before it actually takes place.
Exactly.
Do you know that on Egyptian television on October the 23rd, Mahmoud Abbas says the following: "First of all, let me make something clear about the story of the Jewish state. They started talking to me about the Jewish state only 2 years ago." By the way, that's another method in terms of what you just said with Kevin Rachel. This is another method that all of a sudden it's just 2 years ago that anybody ever brought up the issue of a Jewish state. "I've said it before and I'll say it again. I will never recognize the Jewishness of the state or a Jewish state. This is the man who we want to be the peace partner with Israel?"
Right. And he said something else very interesting, which I thought was what you were going to allude to. And I believe it was in the same interview that he said the Arabs made a mistake in rejecting the 1947 partition plan. Now, people say to me, look, he's acknowledging that he said it was our mistake, it was an Arab mistake as a whole. And I said, you don't understand. What he's saying is 1947 decision by the Palestinians, by the Arabs, was a mistake not to accept the partition plan. He wants to go back and rectify that mistake.
Right.
He wants to go back and negotiate about the borders of 47. That's why he talks about 63 years of occupation.
Right.
That's why he will never recognize a Jewish state. He doesn't believe Israel has a right to exist. And people have to look at this more carefully. There were people who were actually telling me, no, look at this. Isn't that positive? No, I said, no, it's not positive. It tells you what his real mindset is. When he talks about 63 years of occupation, you know where he's trying to put the marker. He's not talking about 67 borders. He's talking about 47 borders.
Excellent analysis. Fantastic. Meanwhile, Bibi says that building will continue in places like Efrat and Male Adumim and places that really would be part, if there was a deal with an enemy that you could negotiate with, that would be part of the quote-unquote Jewish areas of that deal. But these 2,000 units that were announced by the Israeli government seem to ruffle some feathers. Were you surprised at the American reaction to this?
No, well, it's pretty standard policy. The point that is being missed, and when we hear them, and there were statements made this week, I think, by the EU representative and others, that we condemn the attacks against Israel civilians and the launching of missiles. We equally condemn the building of settlements, as if there's an equivalence between launching missiles against hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians and building inside areas, not outside the areas of the existing communities, and in areas that are part of the consensus, i.e. that they will remain with Israel no matter what the deal ultimately will be. And frankly, Israel's going to have to build, because I don't know if you saw the poll this week that showed that 42% of the Palestinians who live in Yerushalayim would move to Israel if their neighborhood became part of a new Palestinian state.
That's interesting.
And 40% said they would prefer Israeli citizenship to Palestinian citizenship. And so Israel's going to have places for them if they let them move. But on a serious note, this is, you know, I wish Israel would build and not talk so much, but they have to make the case about the fact where they're building, that this is, you know, within the consensus. And the PA has to know there's a price to pay when you take the kind of destructive actions, when they essentially abrogate the agreements with Israel by changing the status of the territories by their moves at the UN. It's clearly a violation of those agreements. The United States, the West have condemned them for it. But there's also has to be a price. One of those prices is the cut in U.S. aid, and hopefully aid from others. The second, and Israel took some measures in that regard with the withholding the taxes they transferred to them. And second is that they have to know their consequences. And the international community should be saying, look, it's a peaceful response.
Yeah.
It's not violence. It's not hurting anybody.
You know what they say.
And you can disagree with the building, but these are areas that are in the consensus areas, not
right.
some adventurous move.
It's hard to win a propaganda war when you don't believe your own propaganda. And I'm telling you. And it's impossible because Israel doesn't understand its own case. Like they don't understand how to get out there and state why, you know, like as you just described, why this is completely justified and the normal course of living.
Look at the manipulation on the other side. We mentioned Abbas's speech and your quotes from him. But look, he threatens to resign again. Then he threatens to dissolve the PA. You know, 25 times he's threatened to resign over the last 5 years. Let him resign. You know, the argument always is he's better than the alternative. At some point, he's not better than the alternative.
Well, the media tells us the PA dissolves, it's bad security-wise for Israel. I don't understand that.
Well, there is, because what he's saying to Israel is that we go back to the status quo ante, which means that Israel then is responsible for all of the needs of the people living under the PA areas, meaning that they're responsible for their health, for their welfare, for the, you know, the education, for everything.
Right.
Until now, under being under PA control was their responsibility, and that's why they got all this aid from abroad. Unfortunately, they didn't use it for the right things. And I believe, this is purely speculative on my part, that one of the reasons he might do it is because there's growing awareness of the corruption in the PA, and that his kids have benefited to the tunes of many, many millions of dollars being in charge of the Palestinian Investment Fund. And you dissolve the PA, you take away the records.
Right. Has the author of the infamous Goldstone Report, has he had a change of heart? Just because now he refuses to use the word apartheid when it comes to references to Israel?
I think that, you know, this is the second thing that he's written, which is a partial mea culpa for the tremendous damage he did with the report, which can't be undone. But I certainly welcome it and hope that by virtue of the fact that he joined in that effort, it has more credibility when he says apartheid, calling Israel an apartheid state is wrong, and that it's not comparable to the South African apartheid state. So, you know, we accept people who demonstrate that they do tshuva, that he at least acknowledges that what he did was a mistake. I think, you know, from within his own family, from within the community and others, you know, he recognized the damage that he did. I hope he recognized the damage that he did, and that this, therefore, is an important statement coming from him, because you'd be shocked how many people our polls show believe that Israel is an apartheid state.
Yeah, no question about that. And finally, Malcolm, and over the 2 decades plus that we've had these conversations, you've reminded us many times, I don't know if you'd put it this way, the way I'm about to put it, but anti-Semitism is not always, you know, people rounding up Jews and you know, with the intention of eliminating us. It has many other forms, and of course, anti-Zionism is one of them. But there are other forms as well. And with that in mind, and I don't have it in front of me, so hopefully you could help me with this. I saw an ADL poll. I think it was 30% of Americans are concerned about Jewish involvement in Wall Street. I think that's what it was. And if you pay careful attention, and I have a representation of people, and the story I could tell you off the air, but I have a representation of people who are very, very keen observers of what's happening downtown on the Occupy Wall Street protests. There seems to be this type of attitude growing and growing each time.
Well, I think the number was about 21%, if I'm not mistaken, and it said that the Jews have too much influence there. And frankly, when when they keep using names like Goldman Sachs, which is not a Jewish firm, or Lehman Brothers, or other things which have nothing anymore to do with the Jewish community, largely, they keep reinforcing this image that somehow Jews are prominent. Of course, Madoff and other things highlighted the Jewish presence and involvement, but it's certainly not disproportionate. And if you look at who heads American Express, or you look at who heads, you know, Goldman Sachs or other companies today, they are not necessarily Jewish or even have a predominance of Jewish employees. But there are elements who are participating in the Wall Street demonstrations that have used anti-Semitic references. The obligation is on those who have organized this to root them out, to cut them out, to denounce them. It's not enough just to say that they don't represent them. It has to be dealt with severely. This is not something you can tolerate, because often well-meaning or naive or otherwise people who do not have this agenda can be manipulated that you know, extremist elements take advantage of these circumstances, as we see in the Middle East, as we see in other places. It's one of the dynamics of these kinds of demonstrations, and we have to have zero tolerance for it.
Mm-hmm.
And to, you know, you can't root out the ideas that people have. Anti-Semitism will always be present. Thank God it's rejected by the vast majority of people.
Well, that,
and not in every case is it anti-Semitism to say that
right.
are disproportionate there.
But that is the point. I think too many people think that it's always got to be the 20th century model, and we know what that model is. And the reality is, as you've told us many times, and people have to remember, in the 21st century, it could take on a completely different form.
I mean, it is. The delegitimization campaign does not target Jews individually as it does anti-Semitism generally. It targets the collective Jew. But it's not a difference. It means that they go after the corporate entity that represents the Jews, which is Israel. So when you delegitimize Israel, you delegitimize Jews. When you see these kind of attempts to, that you don't say, well, I hate Jews, but you say Jews have too much power, Jews have too much this. The American people, by and large, do not accept that message, and in many cases where they do, it is not anti-Semitism. They say, you know, this is respect. Some say we wish we had more people involved, right. more down there, and you know, a lot of it's based upon perceptions that the media and others feed, and they're often not careful in the way they report these things.
Where, I don't know why I can't read my notes. Where was that tribunal I read about? The tribunal that a gathering about? Okay, I don't remember.
Next week.
I guess next week, but it's on the anti-Semitism topic. I thought it would be perfect for now. Thank you very much for joining us. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Hohenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update on Friday mornings here at JMN. There's a chance Malcolm will actually be in our studio next week. If he is here, we will take your phone calls and we'll do it for the entire show practically. 7:35 on, whenever he arrives. We'll open up the phone lines and let everybody out there. I know it's been a while since you've had a chance to bounce some questions off of him. We'll hopefully be able to do it next week. If not, then in the near future. But he's going to try to clear his schedule for us for next Friday.